Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy, where I interview entrepreneurs about how they built their businesses. Joining me direct from India, Ashwin, where are you today?
Mumbai, India.
Mumbai, thank you so much for doing this. I know that this schedule is a little bit difficult for the two of us to align since I'm here in the Bay Area. But I've been so fascinated by Ashwin Damera's mission. He's a guy who went to Harvard Business School who said, you know, this is really helpful, but it's available to a limited number of people. What if we could make online educational, really top-tier education available to more people? And so we created a company called Eruditus. It's making high-quality education more affordable and accessible. And it works. And it's backed by people who don't just throw money at things and people with social missions, including the Chan Zuckerberg Foundation that helped invest. I don't know how much did they invest?
I can't say that, but they were part of the $113 million Series D that we just raised.
Which, from what I understand, valued the company at what, $700 million now?
$800 million.
$800, which is a world of difference from the previous company that Ashwin founded. Ashwin Damera in 2005 founded a company called Travel Guru. It was an Indian hotel aggregator, which he sold to Travelocity. What'd you sell that company for? How much?
$15 million, much smaller, obviously.
Bootstrapped or funded?
Funded. We were funded by Sequoia and Battery Ventures. We did really well until 2008 when Lehman Brothers collapsed, and then the entire travel world took a massive hit. But I like to think of that as my investment in learning to be an entrepreneur, and I think second time was much easier. And I think the company Eruditus is now at a much different trajectory.
My understanding was that they put in more money than even the sale price, right?
I think the early investors got their money back, but some of the later investors maybe took a small haircut.
Yeah, talk about an education. Well, here you are, changing education. And I invited Ashwin here to talk about how he's doing this. And we can do it thanks to two phenomenal sponsors. The first, if you're hiring developers, you already know because I've talked about it forever, because people in my audience have signed up for them forever. You should be going to toptal.com/Mixergy. And second, if you have a team of people that you want to coordinate by giving them a clear set of guidelines and if you want to create the training manual for your business, I'm going to tell you later why you should go to trainual.com/Mixergy. First, Ashwin, good to have you here.
Thanks for the opportunity, Andrew. Looking forward to this.
Do you remember what your parents said when you told them that you were going to be an entrepreneur?
Oh, yeah. I just finished business school. I had more than $100,000 in debt. I had an offer to go work at McKinsey in New York City. And I told them that I was going to say no to that, come back to India, and start a business, which would mean that I get no money. I had no investors. I had a couple of my Harvard classmates were going to write me a check. But broadly, I would say that they were shocked. And their first reaction was, why can't you be like your brother, who had a job with HP in Palo Alto and, was in their minds well settled. And I think he was. But I think they came around. I think they said, look, you've got all the insurance you need. You have an MBA from Harvard Business School. And so if something went wrong, that's fine. You'll figure it out. In fact, the McKinsey partner who I had to say no to actually had a very good thing to say. He said, look, go do this. If the company is very successful, McKinsey can consult for you guys. And if it's not, you'll be a better consultant.
That's a good way to look at it. Was there a time when, as you were building a business, you thought, maybe I made a mistake. I kind of wish that I'd gone to work somewhere else, gotten a cushion.
There were many doubts, but I'm not sure the doubt was so much about going and working somewhere else. It's, you doubt yourself, like, am I doing the right thing? Why are so many investors saying no to me? Is my pitch somehow not the right pitch? Is the business plan not sexy enough? So there were many doubts, but I don't think I ever wanted to go back and work. I'm sure in month 11, so McKinsey, by the way, just to be fully clear, were extremely nice. They gave me a one-year deferral. Towards the end of that, when I had this conversation with the partner, I was very thankful, but I don't think I ever really wanted to go back and work. And now it's just impossible for me to see myself working in a large company. When we sold my earlier startup Travel Guru to Travelocity, I spent a year working for them and they were extremely nice, but I was itching to get back to being a founder and starting something new.
You mentioned Harvard Business School. You met some really good people there. Can you give me an example of one of the relationships you formed there?
So my first startup, Travel Guru, came out of a business plan that I wrote as part of a project at Harvard Business School. And when I decided to come back to India and start it, two of my friends, basically it was a business plan. There was no revenue. There was no product. There was no team. There was just me and a business plan. But two of my friends gave me my first check, $200,000. We didn't even call it a Series A or the angel round. It was just money that I had based on good faith, perhaps based on the network, to start. And, like we talked about before, Travel Guru was an okay outcome. I learned a lot. But one of them also then led the Series A in Eruditus. And by that time, he had a venture fund called Wave Capital. Obviously in a much better place now. But, you know, so in two of my startups, I've had my classmates from Harvard Business School actually write me the first check.
Wow. When you came up with the idea for Travel Guru, what was it? What was the original thought that you had?
Yeah, Andrew, it's a very long story, but in the summer between my first year and the second year, I actually got the opportunity of working for JetBlue. I interned for their CEO, Dave Barger. And one of the things that JetBlue was looking at that time was saying, hey, could India be a big market for us? So part of the work I did for them was to look at, is there an opportunity for a low-cost model? Now, this was 2004, so, you know, long time back. And in that discovery process, I had to do a lot of fair shopping, realized that there was no consolidator or online OTA, to say, or meta search that existed in India. And so while, you know, obviously JetBlue didn't go ahead with anything in India, I realized that there's an opportunity to be a consolidator, an aggregator in the travel space for India specifically. That was the business plan that Travel Guru chanced upon. Early in the business, we pivoted.
There was no Travelocity for India? There was no Priceline?
There was Priceline, but not for India. There was Travelocity, but not for India. There was one company called Make My Trip that was actually selling more to non-resident Indians in the US who wanted to come to India for their vacation. And up to that point, actually, there were only two or three full-service carriers in India. And what happened around 2005 was the low-cost aviation boom started. So a bunch of new airlines started, which make the fare comparison more important.
I see. Got it. So as you're doing research for your internship for JetBlue, you're realizing, wait a minute, there's this missing opportunity, a missing piece that would empower companies like JetBlue. Okay. You're going to tell me what you did with that.
So that led to, so I did that, by the way, as part of a field study at Harvard Business School. And then, you know, just kind of out of curiosity, said, hey, let's start a business plan. What would it be if we actually started a business that tried to make money off this fare comparison? That became Travel Guru. And it was a kind of a half serious business plan, really something that was interesting to do. Not sure I wanted to actually pursue it. But then at the Harvard Business School business plan contest, we came runners up. And then we had a couple of friends saying, hey, we'll actually back you. And then I had to make a decision. And I think I made the right decision. It was a brave one, I suppose. You know, at that point of time, the largest startup success in India, if I remember right, 2004, was when eBay bought an Indian company called Bazi.com for $50 million. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, how has the startup world, it's changed completely. Right now we have Indian startups in 10 billion, 15 billion, but 50 million was kind of the benchmark in 2004. So it was a brave decision. You know, I think it was the right decision. I think, you know, I always joke and say that, look, the only difference between an entrepreneur and somebody who's not is that the entrepreneur tried and somebody else didn't. In fact, the only difference between somebody who's successful and somebody who's not, I believe, is somebody tried and somebody didn't. In fact, I define failure as not trying. So from that,
wait, what about this as failure? Trying and then losing all your money, trying and then spending 3 years in agony, not being able to get customers. Isn't that also failure? I could feel the pain of that. I've experienced the pain of that at times in my life.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's like somebody saying, look, I want, you know, I'm trying to do the high jump. I'm trying to cross 3.5 meters. You try 100 times and you fail, and then the 101st time you succeed. So the 100 times you fail, was that failure or was that a stepping stone to success? So I believe that it's failure if you didn't learn from that experience. So, you know, my first startup, I don't think it was a failure. I think it actually did okay. But what I learned is what makes me more successful in my second startup, right? And so it's fine to try something and fail in the definition of, hey, this didn't become a very large financial outcome, but you learn a lot and then you realize what you want to become in life. And if you use that, you're more like, there's a reason why second time entrepreneurs or third time entrepreneurs are more likely to succeed. In fact, there was a VC, I think it was Kleiner, who once told me this. He said, we are more likely to back a so-called failed entrepreneur than a first-time entrepreneur, because at least the failed entrepreneur knows what entrepreneurship is about and what he or she is actually good at.
Okay. And that then helps me understand how you ended up with Eruditus, because frankly, the press on this at Eruditus is unbelievable, because you're taking on such a big mission of bringing education to more people, because you're working with credible institutions, both on the customer base, right? Companies are coming to you and sending and trusting their top people to you. And of course, on the university side, let me spend a little more time just understanding what you learned that first time. You launched Travel Guru. And I know in my intro, I said that it was a Indian hotel aggregator. I got that from a press release when it was eventually sold by Travelocity. But the reality was, when you launched, you had travel packages, you had, from what I could see here, you had hotels, you had airlines, you had the whole thing. It was basically a Travelocity for India. How did you get all of these different companies to work with you? And then we'll talk about how you got customers to come in. And finally, we'll talk about funding. But how did you get all these different hotels and travel companies to work with you?
So you're absolutely right, Andrew. We started off as full service OTA, so flights, hotels, car rentals, all of that. And then, you know, very quickly realized that there's no money to be made in flights. And then what happens, like in many other startups, is that many other people try to do the same thing. And then they raise a lot of capital, and then it's kind of a race to the bottom, right? Especially when you're selling flights, which is a 5% commission business. And so what we did was to pivot to hotels, which was more 20%. Margins, better commission. And then we looked at the opportunity in India. And I think this was an interesting opportunity to go after, actually, which was to say, let's not go after the five-star hotels or the chain hotels, right? Because in the US, that's 40% of the market. In India, 85% of the market is unbranded, mom-and-pop type, family-owned hotels. But they have no internet connection. They don't have any GDS. They don't have distribution. So we had to build a technology that could connect them to our central reservation system. So when somebody came to book, they actually could see whether this hotel had rooms, what room category, what price, et cetera, et cetera. So that was a fun part. And that became an interesting play for us, because it was very difficult for an Expedia or Travelocity, global players, to come in and build those individual one-to-one connects with 3,000 to 5,000 hotels. Which eventually led to conversations of being acquired by many, many people, including Priceline, Expedia, and Travelocity, and eventually Travelocity.
Sorry, but how did you then get, if we're talking about so many mom-and-pop hotels, how did you get them in your network?
So we hired a sales team, and they would go from hotel to hotel. We
literally walking from hotel to hotel? No, phone calls and email.
But they would go meet them. I mean, again, so if you don't meet the hotelier, in fact, you have to go meet the owner, not even the sales guy, nothing would happen, right? And then this is not just Mumbai, Delhi, Bangalore. This is about Goa. It's about Shimla. It's about Darjeeling, Mussoorie. It's like Alibag. It's many, many small places where you actually have a tough time even getting to. But look, that's what makes the market. That's the moat, right? If something is so easy that anybody else can do it, then where's the defensibility?
What was your process for getting them? Did you have a system in place? Did you have anything that allowed you to do this in a more organized way?
So there were two things, right? So you start with kind of we focus more on leisure travelers. So you look at the top 20 leisure destinations and you start going after them. But the bigger thing was, how do you bring them on board on real time? One of the key innovations that Travel Guru did is, if you booked a hotel with us, let's say even if it's in a tier 3 small city, it's a 20-room hotel, and you booked a room with us, you would get instant confirmation of that room. And we would have a 99.7% accuracy in confirming that room. That was a bigger challenge, right? Because most of these hotels were keeping their room inventory on a ledger and writing it down. So what we had to do was to build a technology platform where they would be able to manage their inventory. And not on a real-time basis, but on a batch basis, like twice or thrice in a day, they would connect to our system. Many cases, we would actually give them, say, a mobile phone that they could then use 3G in those days, 4G nowadays, to connect. But that was very, very important, because for the first time, somebody could come in, look at hotels, book, feel comforted that, hey, I've got a reservation and the reservation booked. Now, these hotels, you couldn't book anywhere else. The only other way you could book them was you'd have to call them. And again, you know, when you're trying to find the best hotel, there are like 300 hotels in Goa, you can't be calling many of them, right? So it was really a very valuable service.
So you're saying, Andrew, we had to have a team of salespeople go out, but that's not the hardest part. The hardest part was creating the software so that once you got a new hotel on board, they would want to book with, first of all, they would want to book, I guess, even people who walked in or called up and asking for rooms, book using your system. So your system would know that the rooms were booked and just keep using it even for Travel Guru. That was the challenge. That was the heart of it.
That was the heart of it. And then there were many, many hotels. So when I said we have 4,000 hotels, there were nearly half of them, 2,000 hotels who would say, look, I don't have internet. I can't update the system twice a day. So we actually ran then a 200-person call center that would call these hotels twice a day and say, tell me your inventory for the next 7 days or the next 10 days. And we would have some analytics to know when the bookings would come in, right? So if it's a business hotel, it's probably 2 to 5 days. If it's a leisure hotel, probably 15 to 30 days. So we would then cover for the fact that they didn't have the infrastructure and technology. Obviously, nowadays, all of this is in real time. Everybody's got, you know, they're doing it off their mobile and stuff. But remember, this happened in 2005.
Okay. How did you get customers? How did you get people who were booking travel to come to Travel Guru?
So, you know, when we launched, we got some press, some PR. We also did alliances with a few of the airlines, with Air Deccan, with Kingfisher. We worked with a lot of the credit card companies. So we would do these cashback offers. If you book a hotel, you will get like, you know, 20% off if you book it through a Citibank card or an ICICI bank card, et cetera. We, you know, at that point of time, when we had raised $2 million in a Series A for Travel Guru, if I remember right. So we didn't have a lot of money to spend on marketing. And one of the things that I did realize is that eventually larger players like Make My Trip, et cetera, had raised more capital. And so one of my learnings is that if you're in a space that actually raising capital becomes the moat, either you play that game or you better be in a place where actually there are other more defensible moats beyond just capital. And so that's a separate piece. But, you know, we did a lot of these kind of alliances and partnerships. What we also did, Andrew, was to take the, once we built the technology and the connection with 4,000 hotels, then we actually went to travel agents. And we said, look, you guys want to book hotels across India, but you don't have a good system to do it. So why don't you use our system and we'll pay a cut to you. And so we had a B2B business as well, which also did very well.
Well, I'm wondering, with all these different things in place to lock in your business and first mover advantage, I'm wondering why it didn't work out.
Well, actually did. So here's the inside story, which was just before 2008. I won't take the name of the company, but one of the leading OTAs in the world had given us a term sheet. They were going to acquire the company for 5 times the valuation that we actually ended up selling. And they spent for 4 to 6 months on diligence, and we were about to sign, and then Lehman Brothers collapsed. And this was 2008, July or August, if I remember right. And they were like, look, we're putting this whole thing on hold. And at that point of time, actually, we had about 2 months of cash in the bank. And it was the collective wisdom of the board as well as mine. So I take full responsibility to say, look, we have a deal closing. Why raise more capital? Right? But when that deal fell apart, we had 2 months of money in the bank, and then nobody was willing to invest in that. So we had to take a bridge round internally, which our investors were good enough to do. And then come out of it. Also, what happened that year in 2008, this is a perfect storm, right? There were these terrorist attacks on the Taj and Oberoi hotels in Mumbai, and 99% of our business was hotels. And so we took a massive, massive hit. And so as a consequence of all of that, we, you know, overall travel was affected. 2009, we were coming out, and then eventually the investor said, look, this may be a better place for a more strategic player to invest in and grow, right? And so that's when Travelocity came in. And they were very strong. So if you know Travelocity, they were very strong in flights. They had not had too much success. They were somewhat successful in Indian flights, but wanted to do a lot more in accommodation and hotels. We were a perfect fit for them. And so that's kind of where Travel Guru eventually went. So it was a bunch of things. In hindsight, everybody is wiser, et cetera, et cetera. I actually, by the way, think, and this is why I don't think that was a failure, is I got all of that experience. I got to go work with Travelocity, got a little bit of global experience working for them in Asia Pacific. but then learned so much to start my next company. If I had spent a further 5 or 7 years doing that, I don't think the outcome would have been as large as what Eruditus is today. So in hindsight, it all worked out. But yes, the 2008 was a tough year for us.
All right, let me talk about my first sponsor. Then I want to come back. Before we find out about how you decided to start another company, I also want to get your take on Oyo. It feels like they were solving the same type of issue you dealt with in an interesting, different way. But let me first take a moment and say, anyone out there who's now working with a remote team, one of the things that you might be discovering is that it's harder to communicate with people. And a lot of the communication is, hey, Andrew, I have this problem. How do I solve it? The reason the Trainual was founded is they said every company needs a training manual. But obviously, we're not going to do it on paper. We're not going to do it in Google Docs where it's harder to edit and it's harder to keep organized about what people have gone through and what they haven't. And so the makers of Trainual said, we're going to create a training manual that's easy to do, easy to create, easy to update. And if somebody in your company is now onboarded, they have the best knowledge of all the people who've been there before. And if you decide to change part of your process, everyone who's learned the previous process will just get an update with just the change so that they know just the part that they need to learn. I remember how much I struggled when I started doing Mixergy with a team of outsourced people all over the world. I had to teach every one of them, here's how we book guests. Here's how we follow up with guests. Here's how we deal with customer service issues. And I had to keep being the person who did it. I became the source of knowledge. We moved on to Google Docs. That became a pain because people didn't feel that it was their place to edit. And I didn't know who read the doc and who didn't. I wish the Trainual was around when I was struggling through this. It is around now. If you're working with a remote team, I want you to go and try it right now. They'll give you a big discount if you do. But more importantly, just go see how much better your company could be if you organize it with the proper training manual. Go check out trainual.com/Mixergy. You'll get an understanding of how you can organize your company. And of course, if you decide to sign up for Trainual, which I highly recommend, you will get a big discount from them. That's trainual.com/Mixergy. 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 Oyo seems to have solved, or they were approaching the same problem that you saw, which was in India, lots of different mom and pops owning hotels. It's hard for people to discover them. There is no consistency in any way. They created a brand name, right? Oyo. All these mom and pops were able to work under the brand name. What do you think of that model to solve the problem that you were noticing?
Two quick comments. So in the last year, in 2008, we had started a similar model. We had signed up 3 hotels where we said, look, we'll take all of your inventory. In fact, the biggest competition when you sell hotels, at least in India, was that you would be undercut by the hotel. So somebody would check the hotel on our website, call the hotel. The hotel will say, look, I can give you a 20% discount, book directly with me, and we would lose that. Right? So by what Oyo does actually solves that problem because there's no leakage of revenue. So we had just started that with 3 hotels, and then, of course, the business went a different way. I think the model is interesting, but there are challenges. The biggest challenge that Oyo has is that, at least in the model it had pre-COVID, was they would take the entire hotel to manage, but they would write these minimum guarantees, and that's how they've been able to scale so fast in terms of signups. Now, if you're a hotelier, you kind of know what you make normally. Like, so maybe you're at a 60%, 70% occupancy. You know how much money you make every month. That typically ends up being your minimum guarantee. So the challenge for Oyo is not the sign-up of the hotels, but how do you then scale this to such a great extent that you actually make money by not being at 70% occupancy, but being at 80, 90% occupancy. That challenge is accentuated if you go and sign up 5 to 10 hotels in the very same neighborhood as that first hotel, which is what they've done because they're just so crazy about scaling. So now how do you get all of these hotels to get to 70, 80, 90% occupancy? The other thing they've done is massive discounting of their rates. And so while I think they've done a great job of building kind of a standardized platform where you get standardized service and experience and one brand, I wonder what their financials are, even pre-COVID. I mean, post-COVID, obviously, it's a tougher one. And then, how those minimum guarantees are going to come back and bite.
Right. They did raise a ton of money from, famously SoftBank, though it seems like they also raised from Airbnb and others. You raise money for your first business, for Travel Guru. How tough was that? What was that process like?
Well, you have to go back to 2005 when a standard Series A was like 2 million at 2 pre in India. Today, a standard Series A is like 2 million at 10 pre or 5 million at 15 pre, right? So the world has changed. It was very difficult. There were very, very few early stage VC investors. There was very little angel. There was very little Series A. Like I said, the biggest outcome at that time was Bazi at 50 million, right? So if you were going to underwrite a 5-year outcome of 50 million, what do you think the valuations were, et cetera? So it was a different market, much, much better. A lot of investors have seen money because of Flipkart and, you know, secondary sales and OYO and many other companies. So the ecosystem has evolved tremendously, which is a great thing. But yeah, those were more difficult days.
All right. Where did the idea for Eruditus come from?
So, you know, I was spending a year after selling Travel Guru to Travelocity, and I was thinking about what next. I wanted to do something. So one of my learnings was do something where even if the outcome is large or even if the outcome is small, that I felt fulfilled and happy that I spent 10 years pursuing that goal. Right? So it had some impact. Now, of course, travel, selling happy experiences is interesting, but it's not life-changing, right? And I think some people would argue that. But so I look at two sectors, healthcare and education. And, you know, for some reason, I was the beneficiary of high quality education. It had a huge impact on my life. I would not be here if not for my HBS MBA. And I'll say that openly, and many people will disagree with me, but I don't care. But to me, I was the beneficiary of high quality education. But how could I make many, many more people be beneficiaries of that education? So how do you scale education? So education was very interesting, and I felt personally that it resonated better and more with me. But I was trying to figure out, okay, what in education? It's such a big industry. And then a comment from my chief marketing officer at Travel Guru, who later on went on to become LinkedIn's Asia head, was an INSEAD alumnus. And again, this is the network. So much of this is about who you know, not so much what you know. And so he connected me to my co-founder of Eruditus, Chaitanya, who had worked at INSEAD as an INSEAD MBA, but he had worked in INSEAD in executive education. And so he was very good at designing these custom learning experiences, very high impact transformational journeys. And he and I met, and my first thing to him was, look, Chait, how do we scale this? It's not enough if we can just teach 30 people in a classroom how to become better. How do we teach 30,000 or 300,000? And we hit it off, and that culminated in us forming this company, Eruditus. Which, you know, has changed forms in many ways and has become much bigger than either of us imagined in 2010. And we're so glad that happened. But that really was the genesis of Eruditus.
And so there were MOOCs, these, what is it, massively online, what does it even stand for? Basically, here's what it sounds to me.
Massively open online courses.
Thank you. It sounds like massive mess. It's just, you get to watch a course the way you could watch a Netflix TV show, right? But beyond that, there's very little support. That's my take on MOOCs. What do you think?
Well, I agree with kind of the description of what you do in a MOOCs, but I wouldn't say it's a waste or, you know, the reason is there are different kinds of learners. Look, I've signed up for a MOOC course, for example, on artificial intelligence without even the illusion that I was going to complete it. I just wanted to see, hey, what's going on? It was, I think, a Stanford course, Andrew Ng, somebody was teaching it, right? And so if that was your intent, there are different kinds of learners. There's serious learners, and then there are browsers, right? And so if you're just a browser and you can access courses from the world's best universities, I think there's value to that. Having said that, there was a belief at one time that MOOCs are going to democratize education.
Yes.
And it's going to change everything. That was misplaced. That, I think, was exaggerated. That was misplaced. So there's also a place for what we call SPOCs, small private online courses, where you interact with the instructor, you have smaller groups, you do projects in groups of 4 to 5 people, your class size could be 50, 60. You get feedback, you have to do assignments and get graded to complete. There's also very serious learning outcome-based online education. And I think what happened in 2015, 16 is people focused so much on MOOCs. It was kind of at the exclusion of thinking about, hey, could there be high quality online education? And I think that's a space that we play in. So obviously I'm a little biased. I believe that's a great place. But I would also like to say that I think there's room for many, many models in online, for self-paced as well as synchronous, right? For the library model, right? Pluralsight, Coursera, edX,
right.
Udemy in some sense, as well as high touch online learning with a lot of work, intense work, high completion, but it also costs a lot more, right? So I think there are many models, and, you know, learners are different, learning styles are different. there will be models in the future that will be less video-based, more audio-based, because some learners are auditory versus visual, et cetera, et cetera.
You had this idea that it seems to me you thought our approach is going to be closer to what I experienced at Harvard Business School. Smaller group of people, more interaction with the professor, and more interaction with each other, right?
Absolutely. We are all so driven by things we learn earlier in our lives. And so you kind of nailed it, Andrew. So when Chaitanya and I started, remember Chaitanya comes from INSEAD and ExecEd. So he was this high touch customized program. And the first, actually, the doubt that we had in this business is, could we actually deliver high quality education at scale, right? When we started, most of our programs were classroom, 2010, 2011. But we were taking, for example, an INSEAD EMBA, which was a 18-month experience, compressing it to a one-year program, non-MBA, but very similar content. And it had about 8 weeks of teaching. And we were like, look, we're trying to compress a two-year MBA into like 8 weeks of teaching. Is that even possible? And then when we went online, we had the same question. Like, how do we take the best of a business school, which is, yes, great faculty, but so much of it is peer learning, so much of it is interaction outside of the classroom in those corridors. How do we replicate that in an online environment? Because our true belief was that for us to succeed, right, our mission is high quality education.
Okay.
And so we said, look, even online has to be high quality. There was a perception that, you know, that online is inferior to the classroom. I suspect it still exists, but thanks to what's happened with the mainstreaming of online because of the pandemic, I think that perception that has kind of, you know, changed a lot. But in 2015,
I'm not so sure that I agree. It seems to me like there are a lot of people who are saying, wait, why am I getting this inferior online education when I paid for an in-person program? College specifically, though, I'd say it even goes down to grade school.
They're not comparing apples and apples, right? So you played for college, but that comes with, you know, the experience in the dorm, with athletics, with, you know, a bunch of other stuff that happens, social stuff, etc. So that was your expectation. And you're getting a kind of an online program, but look, nobody's promising you all of that. So okay, the like-to-like would have been that, look, if I just came, so let's say somebody came in at an evening program or a weekend program where they didn't have any of those paraphernalia, but they focused just on the education. And if we deliver that evening program or that weekend program completely online, as far as the education and the networking within that class goes, I think you can actually do a great job.
Okay.
Now, the other stuff that a university life gives you, which I think, by the way, is very, very valuable, right?
Yes.
So I would, for example, say that for a bachelor's education, is that, you know, is it foundational and useful for you to be in a liberal arts college and learn from many other pedagogies and in a bunch of subjects and choose this? And then, yeah, absolutely, right? But for a master's in, say, data science, do you need all of that, or could you just go straight into the curriculum and become a very good you know, data scientist? The answer is probably you can. And that's kind of what we're saying. So as long as you do an apples to apples comparison, Andrew, I think online will hold up. By the way, there are many other advantages of online. So for example, not everybody can come to classroom. So again, think about this from the world. Like today, about two-thirds, so 66% of our students are outside the US. They can't come to an MIT to do that data science course or go to Berkeley to do an AI course. Though those institutions are, you know, cutting edge in research. So if you're sitting in China, if you're sitting in Indonesia, in India, how do you have access? And right. So for those people, actually online is actually better, because the next best alternative was a local college or local university or do nothing.
Agreed. Okay, so I see your vision. What's the first step you took?
So the first step actually was a small experiment where, you know, Chet and I said, look, you know, we also want to make education more accessible and affordable. So we said, let's get a faculty from INSEAD. We got a faculty from the Institute of IIM Ahmedabad, and we did a 10-day program at like one-third the cost of what it would be if you went to any of the top schools
in
India.
You just went to the faculty at INSEAD. That was a school that he went to, I think, that he got his MBA from. You went to the faculty there. You hired them part-time to come and teach. So it wasn't in conjunction with INSEAD. It was just you hired their professors. Am I right?
That was the first step.
That was the first step. And then,
but
so again, no partnership, just, hey, we're putting up a help wanted ad. Let's see if we could get some of their professors. Got it. And then let's see if we can get some students. You know what? I always had that fantasy, Ashwin. I've got to tell you. I remember how much I paid for my undergrad education. I remember thinking, I bet if we got 10 of us together to hire the best of these professors to come and do into our dorm room, in a coffee shop, in a private room, anything, and just teach us. I bet I would have a cheaper education that's much more valuable, closer relationship with the teacher, and the rest I don't need. I mean, I wasn't athletic at all. I didn't need to pay for the big gym that they had at the school that my friends were enjoying. Anyway, that was your vision.
Exactly, right? So it's like great minds think alike.
All right, so you actually did something about it. So you brought them in. How'd you get the students to agree to come and learn this way?
Yeah, we only got 12 students, and that was the catch. Because the point is, how do you go and tell people that, hey, this INSEAD professor is so, so, so good, and this curriculum is actually so good, and that we are so good as a no-name entity at that point of time to deliver this high-quality education to you? So the challenge that we encountered, while we had the same faculty who could deliver great content when they were on campus, we were at one-third the price, is we couldn't convince enough students to believe in that.
What was the class?
It was called Strategic Marketing. It was a 10-day program.
Got it.
It was a very specific, it was taught on weekends, so it was over 5 weekends. And you could argue many, many reasons. And so one of the things that we realized, we actually went back to we sold to companies as well. So we went back to an HR head and said, look, why did you not nominate more people? And their simple answer is, look, if I send a senior employee to an INSEAD program, I know I'm paying more, but if they didn't like it, they wouldn't blame me because it's INSEAD. If I send that person to your program and for some reason they didn't like it, they would blame me because, whose program is it? It's a no-name person. Why did you even send me here? And then we asked individuals. And the individuals told us, look, we come to your program, that's great, but on my LinkedIn, who knows you guys? Nobody.
Right.
So I'd rather pay more and for the time I'm investing and have a brand that signals to people around me that, look, I actually got a good education.
Right.
And so that became a very interesting thing. And that's why I say, Andrew, to my earlier point, is that a failure? Yeah, that experiment failed, but that was the foundation on which we built Eruditus. So the Eruditus model thereafter became saying, look, why don't we work with the institutions? They have the brands, they have the credibility, but let's work with them in getting their price or access, it depends, to a point where actually they meet the market halfway. So we then went to INSEAD directly. My co-founder Chaitanya had worked with the head of ExecEd at INSEAD. And we said, and their problem, by the way, and at that point of time, a lot of universities were looking to get students globally to come to their campuses, right? Whether it was for executive education or even for their degree programs. INSEAD had a unique problem. In their executive MBA, they hardly got anybody from India. In their normal MBA, 12-month residential, they got a lot of people from India. But in their part-time executive MBA, they were not getting anybody in India, and they wanted to get more. So we created this program with INSEAD. It was called INSEAD Leadership Program. It had alumni status. It was not MBA, so it was not giving a degree. And they said, look, if we get 20, 25 people in this program, we'll be very excited. We ended up with 55. And we didn't look back after that. And that was a huge moment for us. I mean, had we got very few people, I don't think we would be here today. Chaitanya and I both worked the phone. I was the chief marketing officer. He was the head of sales. We were head of BD. It was just the two of us. Our wives chipped in. It was basically, you know, the two of us working in our apartments and getting this going. But we learned so much because we understood why these students were signing up, what were their concerns, and what did they want in the program, and et cetera. So in the first year, we had one university. It so happened that INSEAD and Wharton had a partnership, which they still do. So Wharton became our second partner in the second year. Then a Wharton faculty went to MIT. MIT became our third partner in that third year. In the first 5 years, we had just 5 partners, one every year. But we really focused on this product market fit. What do the students want? What do the universities want? What are the universities scared of? I mean, they have-
What did the universities want? What did they want?
So the universities, you know, universities, even if they're business schools, right? I think first and foremost, they're schools, right? So they want a high caliber bunch of students in a classroom. The faculty, for example, they love teaching students in India, for that matter, in the Middle East or Latin America, because these are very engaging students, right? They ask a lot of questions and you had a question.
I think I get, you're saying there's this, it's almost like they're the startups of the education world. These students who are outside the US, you're mentioning India, Asia, you're saying, they want access to these students who are hungry to learn, who have the possibility of growing hugely, and they don't have access to them. They want in on that. The way that I think I get what you're going for. Got it.
Again, when we say students, keep in mind most of these are mid-career professional to senior working executives.
And you intentionally went after them because why did you go? I see that a lot. It's you said we're not going to go after somebody who would do undergrad. We want the person who would nights or weekends or 1 week a year go and learn. Why do you want these people who are mid-career?
So two reasons, Andrew. One is the undergrad grad, the master's or bachelor's level degree programs is a regulated market. And we wanted to stay clear of regulation. That was number one. But the bigger opportunity really was to say that we saw this trend happening where India, China, LATAM, these economies were growing tremendously. And so for a mid-career professional, perhaps with a family as well, but also earning decently well, the opportunity cost to pack your bags, go off to school for 2 years was becoming larger and larger and larger. And so, and then the other thing is I saw this in Travel Guru, the paucity of talent in my managers, right? And you felt this need that you need to upskill and reskill them. And so we looked at all of this and said, look, that's an attractive market to play. And that's where the schools were struggling as well, right? So it was a combination of that. It was not regulated, huge market, and there was a huge need for upskilling and reskilling. If you look at somebody who's 10 years in their career, when they did their bachelor's or master's, they were not taught artificial intelligence or machine learning or robotics or robotic automation, none of that. And yet all of those are the buzzwords, and I would say beyond buzzwords, those are key to being successful today. But none of those people 10 years into the career can go back to a full-time program. And so that was the opportunity that we saw. And especially in a fast-growing emerging market, it's a huge skills deficit.
Got it.
And that's what we wanted to solve.
And fair to say, Ashwin, also that that's where there's revenue, that there's that there are companies that are willing to pay for their executives' education, their executives who have the money and the willingness to do this. Am I right about that?
Look, in education, it's a $7 trillion market. There's money in K-12. There's money in undergrad, there's money in grad, and there's money in post-secondary education as well. So if you were just money-minded, profit-minded, actually the biggest space is K-12. That's where we should have gone. Yes, there is money here. But look, it also seemed like a good fit for us. Ultimately, you have to find, people talk about product market fit. I also always talk about founder opportunity fit, right? I don't think I would have been very successful in K-12, 10 years ago. It's not a space I understand. Working with universities, especially given my co-founder had worked at a university, looking at how we can reach working professionals in India and Asia to start with, where I had spent a lot of time, I thought there's a good product founder fit, right? So that's kind of where we started. And, was it the right place? I think yes. There have been companies in the US, for example, have tried to go to the degree market and then into the skilling market. I think skilling was the right place for us to start. And we might go into other places in the future.
All right, let me take a moment, talk about my second sponsor, and then we'll come back in here. Second sponsor is a company called TopTal. One of the reasons why people sign up to hire developers from TopTal is they have tried hiring on their own and it was a nightmare. It takes way too long. They've tried hiring from these other marketplaces where you can hire freelancers, and a lot of times the people that they hire are undependable. In fact, one of the benefits of using TopTal is that they stand behind the people that they place with you, and you're not just going onto a site filling out a form. You're talking to a human being who will help make sure that you get the right match. Or many people who signed up for TopTal have discovered that they have hired agencies and it takes longer than the agency says at the beginning to get the job done. It's less transparent and it feels more like you're outsourcing your work instead of gaining the expertise internally. So they go to TopTal, they hire a developer from TopTal. It starts off with a matcher who has a conversation with them, who then says, I understand what you need. I'll go to our network and get those people for you. They get the people in front of the company, do a Zoom or a video chat the way that Ashwin and I are doing right now. And anyone who's happy hiring can just hire and often get started within days. And the beauty of it is that TopTal still stands there. They still back their people. In fact, if you use toptal.com/mixergy, not only will they give you 80 hours of developer credit when you pay for your first 80 hours, they're also going to give you a no-risk trial period of up to 2 weeks because they stand by their people. If you haven't talked to them, no obligation, just go have a conversation by going to toptal.com/mixergy. That's top as in top of your head, tal as in talent, toptal.com/mixergy. They've been with me now for about half a decade because Ashwin, people keep hiring from TopTal, which makes me very proud. I see how you got started, how did you get more students in? What was your marketing at that point?
Yeah, initially digital marketing, some B2B talking to companies, very focused in India when we started. Very quickly, we realized there's an Indian diaspora also in the Middle East and then in Singapore. So we expanded to having offices in Dubai and Singapore. And I would say till about 2015, so about 5 to 6 years since we started, it was predominantly classroom, some online, but India and Asia and Middle East. In 2015, we launched our first online course. And I would actually try to think of our evolution as pre-online and post-online. And since 2015, we realized that, look, if you have an online course on design thinking from MIT, there's no reason why you can't market this in Brazil, in Europe, in China, in Australia, wherever else in the world. And then all of a sudden, in a matter of a couple of months, and we went from being, you know, a regional player to being a global player. It took us, you know, it's also, I think, relevant to say that, you know, Chet and I and the people we had, we always had a global mindset. And so when that opportunity presented itself to us, we said, look, why don't we make this global? So we then slowly started hiring a team in the US and so on and so forth. Today, we offer our courses also in Spanish, Portuguese, and Mandarin. 15% of our enrollments are actually in non-English courses. We will experiment with other languages. We have offices in Mexico City, in Colombia, in China, in Shanghai. And so it's become very, very global. And so now we are marketing mostly digital. There's local affiliates as well in different markets. It's a full stack digital first approach.
What did you do to create that in-person camaraderie that comes from standard education?
So, you know, we believe that online can only work if there are two things. One is there has to be real world application. Right. The biggest criticism of MOOCs is that, okay, you learn some content, but unless you apply it, you're really not going to get better at anything. Right. The second is, you know, social learning actually is very important because learning outcomes are better when you actually learn together in groups. And so we try to build both of these elements into the pedagogical tools that we use in our courses. Right. So if you do a digital marketing course, you will have a simulation where you're going to get some credit on Facebook or Google. And then you're going to run a campaign and you're going to learn from that. So that's the real world application
example. With a group of other students.
I was going to get to that. So Sorry. With a group. So the two ways to, the two ways in which the peer learning happens in that. There's one simulation where you work as a team. So four of you together make the decisions and you learn from each other as you're doing that. But we also have one simulation where you do that individually, but then you get the leaderboard, you see what other people do, and then you do a debrief with a group of people, small groups of 5 to 6 people of, hey, what did they do that you didn't do and vice versa, right? And so building in these rich social learning experiences is very, very important. Now, in a classroom, the faculty will just say, hey, why don't you guys just go and huddle there in the corner and figure it out? It's a little more difficult to do online because, look, your students are going to be in 80 different countries. They're going to be in different time zones. And, you know, when you design for, say, 6 people meeting at some time, you've got to assume that 2-3 of them will not turn up. And so how do you design keeping in mind all of these constraints, things that you may take for granted in a classroom, but don't happen in an online environment. And so, but it's fun because when you get that right, then you get stuff like a net promoter score of 50, a completion rate of 90%. People saying, hey, my learning outcomes, 88% of our students actually say that the course met their learning outcomes, right? And that's super exciting because then you can say, look, online can scale, but it can scale with high quality learning outcomes. And that's always been this kind of dichotomy or this question that people have had in higher ed, right? The fact is that, hey, you can't scale education because there's something so personal about a teacher and a student looking eye to eye and learning from each other. But I think online, actually, when you get the pedagogy right, the application, the peer learning scales with good outcomes.
Let me get a little bit more basic with it. When people are working on a project together, are they using Zoom? Are they using video sharing to talk to each other? In between those sessions, are they using something like Slack? What are you guys building in that allows that to happen?
So we give them the option to choose the tool they want. There's a Slack channel that they could use and create the groups and chat about it. Some people use WhatsApp, which is easier. But when it comes to the peer-to-peer learning and the live project debrief, we tend to use Zoom. But in some markets, some countries, that is not you know, favored, and so they can use a different technology if they want. But predominantly, look, the technology per se is not the limiting factor. What I mean by that is Zoom works. You can do project work on Zoom. There are some cases, for example, we have negotiation simulations where you come onto the simulation tool will pair you into a buyer and a seller, and at that moment you will get instructions. It records the negotiation and plays it back for you to go back and do stuff. So that we have proprietary technology that we build on, right?
Okay.
But for the most part, teamwork can happen on Zoom. It can be Microsoft Teams. The chatting that happens between teams can happen on our platform itself, or people can decide to use Slack or WhatsApp or, you know, some other technology.
You know, though, what many people are having now is a challenge of lack of connection when work has gone virtual. So you're seeing companies get together and people are talking about the job, but they're not going beyond the job to the place where they could care about each other enough to have a situation like you had where two students who you went to school with ended up backing you financially, sight unseen, trusting you. It's hard. How do you create that type of connection with someone remotely?
So, you know, we have many courses and some courses are just 8 weeks in duration. So it's difficult to do in that. But we also luckily have 6 month and 9 month duration courses, which are delivered completely online. In those, we do a lot more, right? So for example, we would have in-city meetups. We would have these kind of virtual kind of after hours where people will just come in and they will share something about their country and people will present, share ideas. We will do what we call these marketplace of ideas, which is, hey, I need help in buying a house. Or I need help with can somebody point me to a lawyer who knows copyright law? And then anybody in the group of 40 will say, hey, I can help you. And then they'll connect offline. So we run a lot of these social connect events. In some cases, we try to bring them to campus for a 1 or 2 day graduation, even though it's an online course, because people want to meet face to face. So there are a bunch of these. And by the way, that's very important. And we've seen this post-COVID. In fact, in many of our longer courses, we've also kind of brought in the faculty or a counselor to talk to students about just kind of people are stressed. That's the nature of thing. Some people fall back because they're juggling so many different things at the same time. For a lot of people, the fact that they don't have access to daycare is a big challenge because they're working from home, but they also have the family and the kids to take care of, and they have to do a course. And so we have to support them in those learner journeys, which is also what we do, by the way. Every one of our students, 1:50, 1:75, would have a dedicated tutor. We call them a course leader who supports them during the journey in the course. And we've seen that, you know, the last 6 months, a lot more of that support is required for various reasons, not just the academic part, but also just kind of hand-holding and supporting them as they go through these upheavals in their lives.
I've got a couple of notes here that I wanted to circle back on. One of them is, I remember seeing that you supported India's move to limit Chinese apps. Can you talk a little bit about that? I know that that's a big topic in the world today.
So I didn't put it that way. I said it has to be a two-way street. If there's a country that is banning YouTube, Google, Facebook, etc., then I would suppose that other countries may be within their rights to do the
right.
same. The thing that I actually support is a two-way street where, you know, everybody is allowed. It's a free market.
You're saying there should right? be Google in China, and in turn, there could be a TikTok or whatever the app is.
Correct. I mean, isn't that the best thing for the whole world?
That's what I'd prefer.
That's what I prefer. That's
okay,
what I
so you're saying.
I didn't say that I prefer A banning B and B banning A back. But if it's not a level playing field, then you can understand why somebody may be prompted to do that. That's kind of what I was saying.
Okay. Another thing that I saw in my notes was you said, I think you even said it earlier in this interview, you said you got into Harvard, but no other school, I think you said, took you. That what was going on? Why is it that you feel like Harvard almost did you a favor?
Well, I applied to 4 schools, Harvard, Wharton, Stanford, Columbia. I think I spent most of my attention applying to Harvard Business School. It was the school I did want to go to. Maybe that was partly due to that. But, you know, when I wrote my essays to go to Harvard, it was about doing something in microcredit and having social impact. And I think that resonated very well because, you know, the school at that time had this initiative on social enterprise, and they had a mandate to admit 10% of the students who would go into not-profit or, you know, social types of roles. I could, you know, you could argue that right now I'm doing something on the lines that I actually have always wanted to do, because education is one of those things that has a huge impact. So maybe that's what resonated with Harvard Business School. But, you know, who knows?
All right. What about number of students now that you've had go through your programs and revenue from it?
So last year we had about 50,000 students. Our average course realization is about $2,000. So we were about $100 million in bookings last year. This year we'll double. So 50,000 students going to 100,000 and booking revenue going to 200 million.
Any special, maybe we can close it out with a success story of one of your students.
Well, you know, in our very first batch, I spoke about this INSEAD program. And there was this lady, her name is Rajashree Nayak. She used to work at De Beers. She's always been in marketing. But she has always wanted to be an entrepreneur. But didn't have an MBA, didn't have a business degree. And, you know, has been working for the last, I think, 10, 12 years before she came to this program. What is very, very interesting is she did this program. She quit De Beers. She started her own company. And raised capital and is doing extremely well now. And she credits this program. And by the way, I think one of the investors who invests in the company, she met because of the INSEAD program. The INSEAD program, by the way, part of it has an entrepreneurship kind of get together. It's called the INSEAD Entrepreneurship Dialogue. And she met an investor, one of the INSEAD professors, but they also invested in her company. So to me, this is a great story because, look, she learned a lot, but the network she got in the program, which is something that we are trying to really create, helped us start. But true education, I think, should ignite a fire for you to realize your true ambition. And in her case, her true ambition was to be an entrepreneur. And that program was a catalyst for her to achieve that goal. And that's, to me, a success story.
Yeah, and man, I feel like your company is a success story. Everything that I've read online shows me that this is the model that will work. This is the model that will work for education in many other areas too. I feel like in many times that I've interviewed entrepreneurs who are changing education, it's become more about, let's get to programs like, how do you get people to code? How do you get people to do one specific thing, not shape the way they think? It's almost too hard to shape the way people think remotely. It's almost too hard to get them to connect with other people. So they say, we're going to leave that alone. We're going to focus on getting them a specific result. And you're opening us up to a new model for going beyond that. All right. Why are you even doing this interview with me? I'm grateful that you're here, but I wonder what's in it for you. You've got so many universities that are working with you. What's the upside for you of doing an interview with me? Or I've seen a couple of other interviews that you've done. Why are you doing it?
Well, I think, you know, your interviews are not just about higher education. It's more about entrepreneurship. If there's one message that I would love through this interview for people to hear is that, look, you know, entrepreneurship has many ups, many downs. Yes, 1 in 10. Entrepreneurs will succeed in the traditional definition of success. But I hope people who have heard this have realized that my first startup was kind of moderately successful. I consider it to be extremely successful, but it laid the foundation for my next startup. So this real notion, if I can, you know, leave people with one thought, the idea is that, look, the only difference between them and a successful entrepreneur, the successful entrepreneur started, he or she tried, is an important message to people. I know it's true. I'm not smarter than anybody else. You know, I don't come from a family of entrepreneurs. I didn't have somebody there helping me out. And, you know, and I've had my share of ups and downs, made tons of mistakes, all of that. But I embarked on that journey. And so if you know, after hearing this, a few more people embark on the journey, some of them will be very upset because they may, in the traditional sense, fail. But there will be those one or two who will say, look, maybe, you know, I started this because you kind of gave me the confidence to go out there and try something. That would be an awesome ROI of this conversation. And you have the reach to many budding entrepreneurs. And by the way, I've heard some of your podcasts, you inspire them similarly. So this is a great platform.
I'm looking forward to one of the people who's listening to this interview, at least coming over to you 5-10 years from now and saying, I heard you. I finally decided I was going to do it, or I heard you and I kept at it. And here's what happened as a result. And Ashwin, I appreciate you being here. The website is Ereditus. I feel like I'm mispronouncing your company name. Ereditus.
Eruditus.
Eruditus.
But it's Latin, so you're entitled to mispronounce it as long as you type it in properly. kidding.
All right. And the way to spell it and type it in right is erudits.com. And I'm thankful to the two sponsors who made this interview happen, toptal.com/mixergy and trainual.com/mixergy. Thank you, Ashwin.
Thanks, Andrew. Lovely talking to you.